Let me thank Dan Rosenthal and Professor Hurwitz, excuse me, for arranging all this, and special thanks as well to Professor Moore and Professor Stephen, who are very loyal leaders of the American Society for International Law, and I thank all the sponsors who've been listed by Professor Hurwitz. And I also want to thank the family of Vice Provost Gohar Rizvi for welcoming me and housing me and feeding me and making me feel so welcome again in Charlottesville. I am here primarily not as an investment treaty lawyer. I can talk about that tomorrow. But I'm here tonight really as the president of the American Society of International Law, which is now 104 years old. It's the leading international law society, and I would be remiss not to mention many reasons right up front why all of you as law students should join the American Society. The cost is only $35, which is, I sound like one of those channels on TV, but that's just a few lattes, really, when you think about it. And I have inside information that the price is going to go up next year a few dollars. So I urge you to get in while it's $35. No, seriously, for those of you who aren't members, student members of the American Society of International Law, what you get from being a member is huge. In addition to getting the American Journal of International Law, which is by far the leading peer-reviewed journal of international law, Virginia Journal of International Law. Also, you get International Law in Brief, which is an email broadcast that comes out every 2 weeks, which lists all the recent legislative, regulatory, and tribunal, not all, but the major ones in international law. I think it's now subscribed to by over 10,000 people as the cutting-edge source of the materials that end up in international legal materials. And also you should know ASIL has a program called the Helton Fellowships. I have brochures for these programs for afterwards, as well as the lunch tomorrow. The Helton Fellowships are mini grants of about $2,000 each to help law students and new lawyers who are undertaking human rights projects in the summer or in their first year of practice get the extra plane ticket or the computer or the housing or something that their programs don't allow them to do. We started this program a few years ago when I was chairman of the Honors Committee after Arthur Helton died in the UN bombing. He was a great, great civil rights and human rights lawyer, and we thought giving him a medal wouldn't matter as much as offering funding for projects in the field. And we were at the time aware of three or four law students who had lined up projects but couldn't afford the plane ticket or couldn't take literally a computer with them. So we combined those ideas, and we now give, I think last year we gave out 15 Heltons. So please keep that in mind if you are interested in human rights programs. We also have the networking benefits of our annual meeting, which is just a few hours from here, where usually about 1,200 people are there. It's a very heady, very interesting program, and it is at the same time as the Jessup competition. So there are law students from all over the world there for you to meet, and we have a career I know you thought I wouldn't get to it. We have a career development website and several career development programs during the year, and a book, which I know is important for you all more than ever right now. The real reason to join, though, I would say, is just because if you are a law student interested in international law, I can't tell you how to get to where you want to go to achieve in international law, but I can tell you where to start, and that is with a student membership in the society. So see me if you want any of the forms. Now, in this short talk or lecture that I'm going to give to you, about half an hour, 40 minutes at the most, which is on international tribunals and victims in international tribunals, I am going to mix some biography and career advice in with my substantive topic, because I know that's of interest to students. And I'll start by saying that I have had the good luck and privilege to practice in international dispute resolution. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of room for innovation in that field. There's a an old saying that litigation is the last refuge for generalists, but really international litigation, I think, is the true last refuge for generalists, where we can cut across sectors and topics, but also private international law and public international law. And to practice public international law in the litigation field outside of the State Department Legal Advisor's Office or the Justice Department really is a privilege. It's not a large practice area, but it's quite a fun one. Now, in the field, if you will, of international dispute resolution, there's a spectrum. At one end, we have international court litigation, arbitration, investment treaty disputes of the type Dan mentioned, where there are two parties. The focus is on investment, development, contracts, money damages, liability. That's one end. At the other end, we have international criminal law, obviously, which involves personal criminal liability and war crimes. This is compared to when I was a student at UVA in 1976, 1977, a large area and a growing area, unfortunately, for new graduates and young international lawyers because of the resurgence, of course, the need for the resurgence of international criminal tribunals post-Nuremberg. In the middle, I'm not very good, we're out here for civil and criminal, and in the middle we have this hybrid of international claims tribunals that are set up for large groups of claims, which is my topic today. They're not that well known, which is why I like to speak about them, because they're varied and interesting, and I have personal experience, and I like to expose law students to them because there are often new ones, and in your lifetimes there will be new ones. How did I end up doing so much claims tribunal work? Well, I mentioned luck. I'm here actually doing what I do as an international lawyer because of the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And I think this is, if I'm not mistaken, the 30th anniversary right now, this month, when the Islamic Revolution occurred and the American diplomatic hostages were taken in the Carter administration. And my first law firm, where I worked after a federal trial court clerkship, which I'll talk about at the lunch tomorrow because it was very international, we represented claimants before the then new Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal, which was set up in The Hague under the Algiers Accords, the treaties under which the hostages were released and billions of dollars that the U.S. government had frozen of Iranian funds in the U.S. banking system were sent back to Iran, except for $1 billion pot that was used to pay American claimants who could show a breach of a contract or an expropriation in the course of the Islamic Revolution. This was really the start, in many ways, of the modern, transparent, publicly available body of public international law in investment and other claims. And then as I worked on that in the private sector, I was then recruited by the State Department Legal Advisor's Office to do international claims for the U.S. government, among other things, and I eventually became the U.S. agent at the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal in The Hague, which is the equivalent of being the U.S. attorney. I was the advocate for the U.S. government in any treaty interpretation cases. I advised the lawyers for the private claimants, and behind the scenes, we did quite a bit of negotiating with Iran. This has all been written about now, but we had a lot of negotiations over the release of the hostages in Lebanon because the U.S. and Iran don't have diplomatic relations, didn't then, but we were able to use the tribunal to have contact between the legal advisors on different matters. And many of us who are now getting a bit grayer in the international claims field met each other as young lawyers, as either State Department lawyers or law clerks at the Iran Tribunal, and we're the veterans still get together quite often. Now, I'm mentioning this for two reasons tonight. The first is to be very, very clear that your opportunities as you depart law school will be very different than mine were at age 25. No one knew there'd be the Iran Tribunal, but for that crisis. No one knew there would be the UNCC, but for the crisis. And in your careers, there will be new legal institutions and new initiatives happening that you need to be aware of. And if you get involved in one of these courts or tribunals, you will have your own tribe. And then 30 years from now, you can stand up and be one of the veterans. But there's no point looking at a career of someone like me and saying, gee, I would like to do that. You can't do that because it's going to be completely different for you. The opportunities will be completely different, more in the criminal field, among other things. The second thing I want to say is, if you pursue a career in international law, you can't expect constant thrills. Even in international dispute resolution, surely international law is expanding. We're developing customary international law. There are exciting issues sometimes, especially when we see new customary international law emerge. But most of it, like any work, is more prosaic. We, just like any lawyers, we have to focus on our procedural skills and our functional skills. You can guess it, document review, drafting, practicing advocacy. For example, our new associates at Freshfields in New York, who started in October, spent their first week, I'm sorry to say, site-checking a 325-page memorial we submitted in an ICSID case against Venezuela that had exactly, we didn't plan this, but it had exactly 1,000 footnotes. So those of you who work on law journals know what this entailed. And when students ask me, what should I take if I want to do international law in a law firm or in a State Department even, I always say, you should be taking evidence, civil procedure, accounting for sure, things to do with numbers, corporations, securities, UCC, all of those regulatory subjects that don't sound as interesting as public international law, as well as seminars in international law and the common law subjects. And I have just a few slides tonight because I don't want to do that hypnosis thing with PowerPoint for you. Just a few quotes and some website addresses, but as I talk about these prosaic things, I want to mention that I did have the privilege of giving Hague lectures on private international law in 2001 on the incredibly self-important, I don't know what I was thinking, topic of, quote, mixed private and public international law solutions to international crises. But this was the heart of my lectures, where I talked about how the whole European community started as a in the steel sector. And I wrote in the introduction to my lectures, you can read it over my head, I'm sure, that issues of roofs and hearths and coal and steel and bank transfers, claims forms, computer systems, regulations, unglamorous, untheoretical things comprise the currency most in demand in the mixed private and public international law tribunals that I'll be talking to you about tonight. So, with those unsolicited career lessons behind us, let me turn to the theme. I want to describe very quickly several successful claims commissions and tribunals that have dealt with commercial disputes or post-war victims' claims and compare them a little bit with international criminal tribunals, trying to keep an eye on the victims that lead to the development of these ad hoc commissions and tribunals, because that is who we serve, are the victims. Some of these tribunals are well known, some are not, some last 20 months, some last 20 years, but they're all tribunals, and as tribunals, they have some common features. There are always judges, obviously, or commissioners and arbitrators who are appointed by the participating governments. They all have or they borrow a secretariat and a registry. They all have or they borrow a headquarters with offices and computers and typewriters, things like that, secretaries, file rooms. And they all have law clerks or assistants for the judges, which is an area I think, great opportunity if law students can dig these positions out. And they all have, of course, some level of diplomatic privileges and immunities. Tonight I'm going to mention the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal, the UN Compensation Commission, the Holocaust Tribunal, The real property commissions in Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Kosovo, and the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission, and then end with a little bit on the ICC, the International Criminal Court Victims Process, because these, it's not magic, but these are the ones I know best from working on them. There are dozens more, and there will be more, and I've put up for you a very important website, which is the NYU Law School Project on International Courts and Tribunals. If you want to find what exists in this area and what they're doing, and often if they're looking for interns and clerks and young lawyers, you can go to this website. I'm not going to go through these one by one, but I'll go through three of their common attributes. But just as background, I first thought about these issues in this way. In other words, I did all these things, but I never had taken the time to try to put them together in a certain way until I was asked to prepare a speech at the second Chautauqua Conference for the International Criminal Prosecutors in the fall of 2008, including the ICC prosecutor, Luis Ocampo. And I was asked to give the keynote address to try to explain to the criminal prosecutors, the modern criminal prosecutors, and all the living Nuremberg prosecutors who were there. It was quite an exciting conference. What claims commissions are, and in my opinion, why they shouldn't overlap too much with the criminal proceedings, but what the different objectives are at these dialogues. And we had the third International Humanitarian Law Dialogues at Chautauqua this fall. And I'm sorry that you all can't be there, because what it is a retreat where the Nuremberg prosecutors, and we seem to lose one each year because they're all about 90 or older, come and give the benefit of their experiences to the prosecutors from Sierra Leone and the ICC and the ICTY and the ICTR, and we provide time for them to talk to each other, and then there are some public programs. But it's one of the best things that I think that the American Society sponsors. And it is open to the public if you want to watch next year, right after Labor Day. But it made me reflect on the questions of what are the purposes? What really are the purposes of international claims tribunals compared to criminal tribunals? And the answers, of course, inform the characteristics of each. And it boils down to this, that in international claims, we're coming from the opposite direction in one sense that prosecutors come from. And I'm simplifying here, but the primary goal of a prosecutor, of course, is to punish an individual perpetrator of an international crime, ideally to deter future violations, and ideally to avoid future victimization. Targeting on a person. And the claims commissions, our goal is to compensate and directly relieve the suffering of victims of past international law violations with no desire, or no, I don't know, I shouldn't say no desire, no expectation that we have a deterrent effect, because the compensation doesn't come from the perpetrators, the compensation comes from governments, usually. So this can be in the criminal or civil side. Of course, we're working towards the same goal, because bringing criminals to justice is also a tribute to victims. You know that from your basic criminal law courses. And criminal prosecutions do help restore dignity to victims and bring closure to victims in ways that are sometimes more important, sometimes less important than any idea of compensation. Here are a couple of good websites for you if you're interested on international criminal tribunals that come from, I picked these up in Chautauqua. The first, of course, is the Robert Jackson website. You know that he was the US Supreme Court Justice who was named the first Nuremberg prosecutor. There's a think tank, a center for Robert Jackson on international criminal law and impunity in Jamestown, New York. They publish wonderful things. And then there's ImpunityWatch.com, which comes from a program that David Crane, who was the first prosecutor of Sierra Leone, has set up at Syracuse University. A lot of programs going on through Impunity Watch. Now, finally, to focus entirely on claims tribunals. There are three common institutional characteristics I'll talk to you about. One is fixed compensation categories, two is low standards of proof, and the third are mass processing techniques, which all fall under my category of rough justice. Fixed compensation categories. Remember, these are civil tribunals, and these tribunals give remedies in the form of monetary compensation, usually sometimes asset restitution. There's no punishment. There's no aspect of fault or punishment here. Typically, claimants who are represented by themselves or by their governments are grouped into classes based on the type of harm that they suffer. It can be death, personal injury, or expropriation of property. And each member of the same class generally receives the same fixed amount if he or she satisfies certain criteria. It can be very small. It can be very small. Let me get specific instead of general here. The UN Compensation Commission, or the UNCC, was set up after Iraq's unlawful invasion of Kuwait and the first Gulf War in 1990. And you may recall, or you have learned, that the United Nations found Iraq in breach of the UN Charter for illegal use of force in invading Kuwait and at fault under international law. So the UNCC's job, it was based in Geneva, was to not find fault, but to identify and compensate victims. There were many categories, from the guest workers from developing countries who had been working at low-level jobs in Kuwait, who had to flee immediately, losing all their method of livelihood or means of livelihood, all the way up to the corporations who lost their assets, to the state of Kuwait, which lost billions and billions of dollars in environmental damage from flared wells, et cetera. And again, we're not very creative in this field. We had categories there called Category A, which was those who were forced to flee because of the invasion. Category B, those who suffered personal injury or death of close family members. And Category C, which were business losses of under $100,000. Those categories, A, B, and C, received priority early payment of a fixed sum of $2,500 if they got through the process. Now that, you might be sitting there thinking, wow, you lose your parent, you lose your child, you lose your whole business, and you get $2,500. That's not much for Lucy Reed to be talking about. But, as I say on this slide, at the UNCC, there were 2.6 million claims filed with the UNCC, all but 7,000 by individual human beings in categories A, B, and C. And the small fixed sum awards was the only way to ensure prompt and reasonable payment to them in a way that could help them start reestablishing their lives. And at the end of the day, millions of these small claimants, we call them, received these small amounts totaling billions of dollars by the time everyone received his or her $2,500. Where did that money come from? Well, it came from the UN Oil for Food Program. And is still coming from the UN Oil for Food Program, which is a story for another day. But I spent a bit of extra time on this because I'm very proud of this aspect of the UNCC. Remember, I mentioned there were veterans from the Iran Tribunal. And at the Iran Tribunal, we tried and failed to get the small claimants paid early. There, the small claimants were companies or individuals who lost less than $250,000. And the State Department, our staff at the State Department, represented them all together and tried to get lump sum payments for them up first. But we were, basically outmaneuvered by Iran. And at the end of the day, the small claimants got their cases decided last, which meant that the corporations got paid first. And the individuals who had been working in Iran or setting up their small businesses, including people I still keep in touch with who set up small translation companies and things, who lost everything, had to wait for years and years until they got these small amounts of money through the Justice Department. And we were determined that this shouldn't happen again. You rarely get a second chance, but we didn't want this to happen post-Iraq So we spent a lot of time on this small claimants program there. Now, obviously the theory is that, as I say, rough justice is better than justice long delayed. So quick payment of small amounts is the way these big claims commissions have gone. But not all of these commissions award money. Some have been restoring assets, which continues to surprise me. And so I'll mention the Commission for Real Property Claims for Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was set up as part of the Dayton Accords at the end of that conflict. The purpose of that commission was to identify and return real property to claimants who had been forced to sell or abandon their homes during the Yugoslav conflict. I think you may not recall, given how young you were at the time still of this conflict, but more than half of the homes in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia were destroyed, leveled to the ground, certainly without roofs, and that is one of the sources of the greatest difficulty of returning a society to peace, is having homes returned and made livable again. So this commission, the purpose of this commission was to try to undo that. There was a big commission. They had, 500 people working there based, they had various headquarters, and the arbitrators would literally go out in the field in flak jackets and bulletproof vests, visiting apartments and houses and not always verifying, but just looking at the situation in different villages about what had happened. And there were, at the end of the day, I think about 300,000 claims brought to this commission. And the commission thought, if someone wants his apartment or her apartment back, if we can give it back, we'll give it back. But for most of them, we can just give money. Because you know from the ethnic conflict that people, their villages were off base. They couldn't go back safely. So instead, they gave to the claimants the option of taking vouchers. If I could prove that I had lost an apartment with X square footage, because they don't have deeds like we have it or land title, but say X square footage in one village in Herzegovina, but I couldn't go back, I got a voucher that said, you lost in the war an apartment of this size worth roughly X amount of dollars. And it never was planned, but to everyone's amazement, a parallel real estate market developed where you could take these vouchers from the apartment that you could never go back to and buy an apartment in a now safe ethnic village for yourself. So in many ways, it was a great peacekeeping effort of a claims commission. And there's a similar one that's going on right now for Kosovo, which has processed tens of thousands of claims. Small number of commissioners, no advocacy, just out there trying to help return homes. You'll recall my first slide where I talked about roofs and hearths and these issues as being very important. The second notable feature of these commissions is that they operate with a very low standard of proof. It's administrative, largely, not like a courtroom that you would see on television. Now, this is going to seem strange for those of you who are familiar with litigation. The two sides don't have lawyers. They don't have advocates. The tribunal has the fact-finding powers, and everything is done almost always in writing. And that works because of these relaxed standards of proof to establish the facts of a particular category of cases. Why do we have to do this? There's so many claims. There's just so many of them, and there's not normal evidence. For example, those fleeing a conflict for their lives don't think to grab their property deeds or their bank books, usually. They cannot get them back. So let me give you again, I have this up on the slide, some concrete examples. At the UN Compensation Commission, there was a presumption of unlawful expulsion. Now, for those of you who don't know, in international law, it's against the law to expel a national from his or her territory without cause, even in a conflict. So there was a presumption of unlawful expulsion for any of those individual guest workers, for example, who could show that they had been in Kuwait by producing a visa or a passport and that they were no longer in Kuwait after the war. it's not quite this easy, but basically automatic $2,500 if you could do that. In the Real Property Commission, they didn't require proof of ethnic cleansing or a causal link between ethnic cleansing and property loss. Again, they operated on a presumption that any displaced person was displaced because of the war. Claims Resolution Tribunal, where I served as co-director, looked for what they called the plausibility in light of all the circumstances that a claimant was entitled to a particular bank account that had been dormant since World War II. This is the tribunal, it was called the Holocaust Tribunal. It was set up by Paul Volcker, formerly head of the Fed, still very active, and the World Jewish Congress, among others, to find and return funds that got stuck, if you will, in private Swiss bank accounts at the end of World War II. For many years, the Swiss banks said there weren't any of these accounts. There were various audits, and they said there weren't any. Don't worry about it. And in Switzerland, unlike here, where if you don't have activity in your bank account for a certain number of years, the bank just takes your money and gives it to the state, usually. But in Switzerland, they never empty bank accounts. They just stay there. And through the efforts of Paul Volcker and the World Jewish Congress, they found, at the end of the day, hundreds of thousands of bank accounts that had been dormant since World War II. Now, they were not all Holocaust victims, believe me. There were many accounts that we found that when we started to get information were accounts set up by French businessmen for their mistresses, which their relatives weren't so happy to hear from us. So we had to take that into account. But the Claims Resolution Tribunal Phase 1, which I chaired, matched 5,000 dormant accounts to heirs of the original holders by use of names and other things. But what the claimants had to show was plausibility in light of all the circumstances that claimant was entitled to the money. And they didn't know how much money was in the account. So we weren't out for gold diggers. We never told the claimants how much was in the account. Now, we don't have many law professors here tonight, but if you were to say to your civil procedure or criminal law professors that a good standard of proof was plausibility in light of the circumstances, I think that you would fail the class, and rightly so. But what else can you do when some of your claimants are Holocaust victims or relatives of Holocaust victims who did not have death certificates from Auschwitz, who did not have, from 50 years ago, the passbook to a private Swiss bank account, which is what the Swiss banks had been requiring to release this money for decades. And I'll put up for you the rule of the Claims Resolution Tribunal that sets out this standard of proof. It's quite long, but you'll see some of the things we have to craft when we write rules for these ad hoc tribunals. It talks about a finding of plausibility requiring that all documents and other information have been submitted by the claimant regarding his or her relationship with the account holder that can reasonably be expected to be produced in light of the particular circumstances, including the history of the claimant's family and whether or not the published account holder was a victim of Nazi persecution, and that no reasonable basis exists to conclude that fraud or forgery affect the claim, or that other persons may have a better claim. I am happy to say that in all the work we did on the Claims Resolution Tribunal, there was only one fraudulent claim where someone came in and just tried to show a connection on pure fraud. There was a great deal of dignity in that tribunal. And again, these standards of proof are what are necessary where the commissions aren't worried about fault for loss. That's a given. The Swiss bank said we'll give these accounts back to someone who has a connection to them. It's finding out more about the fact of the loss. Now, the last thing I'll talk about is what we call mass processing techniques. Again, we're very uncreative, you know, mass processing techniques. That's what we call it. These are the specialized methodologies to process hundreds or even millions of claims. You're probably not familiar with U.S. insurance or tort litigation, big class actions, but it's similar to that. We use statistical sampling and modeling computerized matching and verification or valuation of claims. The UNCC was the pioneer of this. They, for the first time, in fact, one of my colleagues at the Iran Tribunal, Norbert Wühler, who was head of the legal division from the Max Planck Institute, became the general counsel, the head of legal for the UNCC, and he said, I will do it only if the next person you hire is a computer software legal expert who can write all the computer programs to make this possible to collect and process these claims. It's there that they used the computerized claim forms for the first year, not hard copy. The U.S. government, for example, had to collect all the claims of U.S. nationals in all those categories, A, B, C through Z, fill them in, put them on disks, send them to the UNCC, and they were able to load them into their hard drives and match and sample and test things. So let me give you a simplified example here, because it all sounds very abstract. Say country X submits small business loss claims for, I have it on the screen, 500 nationals. Each person has put in, or business has put in, a claim form with some supporting evidence. The commission staff looks at a statistically relevant sample. Let's just say it's 10 out of 500. I don't know what it was. And if only 40% of those 10 files, four of those files, meet the standard of proof, which is low anyway, but if only four meet it, each claimant in that whole group of 500 gets 40% of $2,500. So everybody is penalized if the government does not carefully screen the claims and keep people from claiming more businesses that never existed, things like that. So it's self-policing. I think your professors would accept the standard of proof if you can tell them that that's how things are taken care of. And I don't know whether anyone in this audience cares about this, but to the extent law students are good at computer software and analytical statistical thinking, there is a great demand for lawyers in these claims commissions who can do this. Now, that's a little early. I'll just end this by saying I sound like I'm painting, I think, too bloodless a picture. And I don't mean to say that these claims commissions are all process and computers and nerdy people running around and no compassion for the victims. It's the opposite. We all spend a lot of time reading the stories and listening to the stories of the victims. Certainly we did in the Claims Resolution Tribunal, and I certainly have done so in the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission, where we received a lot of witness testimony from victims of Geneva Convention violations in that armed conflict from 98 to 2000. And people ask me how I can do it sometimes, and I don't think any of us as judges in these commissions, including a post-war commission, lose our compassion at all. But as with in many professions, we have to maintain a certain discipline and a certain distance from the individuals who are coming to us for relief, as well as remaining a judge of credibility at all times. So let me talk very briefly about the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission, on which I sat, because we finished our work after 7 years, in August, as one of five commissioners. This is the first ever international tribunal that was set up to decide civil liability, not criminal liability, which is more normal, for violations of the Geneva Conventions in international humanitarian law, the law of war, the impact on civilians in an armed conflict. There had been a boundary war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, as I say, from 98 to 2000, was fought with World War I methods, basically, trench warfare. Huge fatalities, huge. And Eritrea and Ethiopia chose not to ask for a criminal tribunal and not to go with mass individual claims, although they could have, but to it's called espousing claims. Each government represented its national victims in front of us by filing categories of claims. These included prisoners of war, wrongful expellees, which I mentioned, national civilian victims of abuses like rape, illegal detention, beatings, murder, and other unpleasant things, and the record included witness statements and oral testimony, as I say, a lot of claim forms and a lot of collation. The Eritrea and Ethiopia bifurcated liability decisions from damage decisions, and all of our awards are available for anyone to see, fully transparent on the Permanent Court of Arbitration website. We found each government in violation of jus in bello. Jus in bello is the law of war for violations of methods of warfare and unjustified attacks on civilians, for example, including mistreatment of prisoners of war and civilian detainees, including hiding prisoners from the ICRC, which is a very serious offense, physical abuse, mental abuse, occasional, thank goodness, only occasional rape and sexual violence, forced labor, property destruction, and massive economic damage to internally displaced persons, which is where a lot of the most impact is on was on women and girls. We also found, and this has been very controversial, that Eritrea violated the jus ad bellum, going to causation of the war, in invading Ethiopia, in illegal use of force in violation of the UN Charter. We then had to spend a lot of time assessing what impact that had on damages or not. These two very poor countries claimed billions and billions of dollars of damages to their civilian populations, separate from the cost of running the war. At the end of the day, because we're a arbitration tribunal applying rules of evidence, even with a relaxed standard of proof, we found very, very rough damages phase. We awarded Eritrea about $160 million and Ethiopia about $170 million, which, as we said in our award, is nowhere near what they suffered, but it's what they could prove they suffered. Now, there are one other organization I want to mention to you is the International Organization for Migration, which is an international organization in Geneva, which has run claims programs for German insurance claims from World War II, World War II slave labor, Roma claims, claims for gays, all victims from the war period. They're running now an Iraq claims program. They have for years been working for and planning an Israel-Palestine claims program where they're talking about returning properties and giving compensation in those areas of the world. Very, very interesting organization, worth watching. Now, very last topic, very quickly, in a big development, a very big development, the International Criminal Court has a little publicized aspect to it, which is a parallel claims commission for victims with participation rights for victims. It's called, it's called the Trust Fund for Victims. It's got an independent board that Desmond Tutu was on. They're changing right now. And it allows victims to advocate for, the Trust Fund to advocate for and assist victims of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And under the regulations that are adopted by the Assembly of States parties to the ICC, to the Rome Convention, victims are, it's a selection process, but victims are allowed to come and testify in criminal proceedings as normal witnesses, like, I saw this, this happened, this person did this, but also to testify for claims for compensation for their damages as victims. Right now, the fund has done outreach efforts in Uganda and has assisted war victims in the Congo. The first actual participation process is coming up now in the ongoing trial of the Congolese militia leader, Thomas Lubanga. And the prosecutors, you probably mostly know this, Ocampo indicted Lubanga only for child soldier violations, for enlisting, conscripting, and using child soldiers to fight for his Union of Patriots. So far, 99 victims are being represented by 7 lawyers at the ICC in Lubanga. They met this test of proof. They have claims forms, just like I've talked about. You can look on the ICC website. They have to fill them out. But 99 people have been selected to prove links to crimes and themselves. And the victims' lawyers are able to be in the courtroom through all the proceedings and to speak up to some extent and present their clients' views, which is a first, and the prosecutors and the defense lawyers don't necessarily like it. And I will tell you why, because and I should disclose that I'm advising a group of child soldier victims myself, which is an expanding group working with Redress, which is an organization in Britain fighting against torture. But in the spring, during the Lubanga proceedings, during the prosecution case, the prosecutor obviously goes first, listening in the courtroom to the evidence, the victims' lawyers, and our main lawyer is a local lawyer, not us, moved to add charges of sexual slavery and cruel and unusual punishment to the indictment. Why is that? Because they sat there and listened for months to these child soldiers give testimony about their raping and sexually abusing girls in the course of their conscription and their fighting for Lubanga. And the victims' lawyers urged that the indictment be broadened to cover this. And on July 14th, last summer, the trial judges ruled it is possible to add new charges on fresh evidence, even if the prosecutor wasn't volunteering it himself. It's very controversial. Both the prosecution and the defense have asked for leave to appeal this decision. And correct me, Dean Hurwitz, if I'm wrong, I think that's still pending. And if it's granted, it will slow the defense case, which otherwise starts up in October and might have to reopen the whole investigation. So bottom line is, in my opinion, it's always challenging to mix victim witness testimony on the facts of a criminal event and his or her desire for compensation. But this is a laudatory goal if it's kept in control. And it is not at all an impossible dream that convicted war criminals who have stashed away billions of dollars in conflict diamonds, conflict gold, laundered money, whatever. That's not the Lubanga case, by the way. But in that kind of case, one day, victims may be able to be compensated from those illegal gains in modern international criminal cases, given the kind of warfare that your generation is seeing. And the reason I think it's not impossible, and this will be my last remark, is that for 50 years, people thought it was impossible to find the dormant Swiss bank accounts that had been lost to the concentration camp victims. And that's now been done thoroughly, including with sanctions against those who deprived the holders of those bank accounts of their assets in the first place through arbitration and litigation. So I think there are a lot of new opportunities for your generation of law students. I can't even predict what they will be, what commissions there will be, what offenses there will be that need writing in this kind of hybrid commission or tribunal. So that's the end of my presentation. Thank you for being such good listeners.